Welcome to Hacker News Daily, a show from the Bree Podcast Network. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. Today we are covering 8 stories from the front page of Hacker News, starting with a defense of a bare-bones approach to web development, and ending with how researchers are trying to open up the black box of large language models.
Let's get into it.
First up, a straightforward argument. Frameworks promise scale and structure, but you don't actually need them. That's the core of a post by developer Goosing, simply titled, Why Vanilla JavaScript?
Right, and the discussion on Hacker News picked up on that exact point. Commenter Benowo agreed that it's very easy to accept that frameworks help teams scale, but the underlying message is that plain JavaScript remains a completely viable choice.
The tension here is about intention. Picking a framework like React or Vue establishes shared ground rules for a whole team, which matters for long-term maintainability. Going framework-free can feel like chasing a tighter, more elegant solution, but critics say it might just be solving problems you created for yourself.
So the real question isn't whether vanilla JavaScript works. It does. It's whether modern teams still have an appetite for that bespoke trade-off, where programmer joy competes with the safety net of a widely understood convention.
Shifting to what people are actually building right now, David927 has posted the July 2026 What Are You Working On thread on Hacker News, and it's already pulled in 88 points.
These monthly threads are a consistent pulse check. You see a raw stream of side projects, early stage startups, and experiments. It's basically a public checkpoint where solo developers and small teams toss out ideas to gauge interest from a very technically literate crowd.
And the comment count isn't even listed yet, but the vote signal points to steady maker activity. You find a mix of speculative prototypes and more polished minimum viable products. Sometimes it's just a landing page, other times a fully functional tool.
What makes this thread so valuable is that it serves as a leading indicator. You spot concepts here that might later surface in official launch announcements or even funding rounds. For anyone tracking the frontier of independent software, it tells you where individual energy is concentrating right at this moment.
On the subject of solving real-world systems, Google Research has published work arguing that collaboration, not just pouring more concrete, is the key to reducing traffic congestion.
The idea is that a small fraction of drivers using real-time navigation guidance can measurably smooth traffic flow. By rerouting just a few vehicles, you can prevent those infuriating stop-and-go waves that ripple through crowded corridors.
So instead of costly new infrastructure, the focus shifts to using existing road capacity more intelligently. It relies on shared data and coordinated route suggestions, almost like a behavioral nudge supported by algorithmic support.
Exactly. It's a much cheaper, faster intervention. The signal here is that traffic is as much a coordination problem as it is an engineering one. And the solution might just be in all of our pockets already.
Milo, do you have a favorite cyberpunk comic? Because a new reader's guide just mapped out where to start, and it splits the genre neatly across formats.
I have to admit, I'm more familiar with the anime, but the guide is clear. For Western graphic novels, the definitive starting point is Warren Ellis and Derek Robertson's Transmetropolitan. It channels a kind of Hunter S. Thompson energy through a dystopian cityscape.
And for Japanese manga, Masamune Shirow's The Ghost in the Shell is the foundational pillar. It really defined the genre's deep, philosophical questions about consciousness in a hyper-connected world.
The guide draws an interesting contrast. Western stories often lean into societal collapse and satirical journalism, while Japanese cyberpunk consistently explores that blurry boundary between human and machine. And for anyone wanting the purest visual expression across both cultures, the article points to the work of the artist Mobius, whose aesthetic shaped how we picture dense, lived-in futures.
Let's talk about content moderation and AI. A user on Hacker News, Levkick, has posted a proposal that's getting significant attention. A dedicated flag for articles that are AI-generated.
This one is really a sign of the times. The suggestion isn't for a punitive downrank. It's for a neutral indicator that would let readers who prefer human-written text simply skip those articles.
The proposal explicitly acknowledges that Hacker News has historically been resistant to fundamental changes. It frames the whole discussion around whether the platform needs a novel response to the generative AI era, raising the open question of why the existing voting system isn't enough to filter for signal anymore.
That's the emerging friction point. A community built on intellectual rigor is actively searching for new curatorial tools to manage what they see as a coming flood of synthetic text. It's a debate about preserving signal to noise, when the noise can suddenly be produced at industrial scale.
In a related vein, a piece by Sam Khan, co-founder of the Republic of Letters, is resonating with readers. It's a personal account of literally learning how to read again with focus and intention.
He describes an environment that deliberately cultivates short attention spans and dopamine cravings, making the sustained comprehension of a book feel deeply unnatural. What's powerful here is that he frames deep reading not as a lost faculty, but as a recoverable skill.
And his method isn't just about willpower. It's about restructuring his habits and environment to protect deep attention. The article has pulled in over 100 points, which suggests this is a shared struggle for many people who grew up with screen-shaped skimming.
Right. It offers a practical counter-narrative to the idea that our brains are simply and permanently fractured by digital life. For anyone feeling that loss, the message is that the appetite for books can be rebuilt.
We're going to close out with something a bit more tactical. Oan Altayunu, writing in Motive Notes, makes a case for embracing things that aren't immediately useful.
She describes being at an event in a Brooklyn warehouse where someone handed her a piece of paper. That paper was actually a running computer program. You could plug a keyboard into it, save new code, and the paper would turn green.
A completely impractical system, and yet it's rich with signals. Her core argument is that useful companies are built on the stubbornly useless research that came before them, and that optimizing everything for immediate utility can choke off the very exploration that later supports entire industries.
It's a warning against a kind of efficiency trap. She invests in both stages, the short-term useful and the long-term exploratory, and suggests that if you aren't funding things simply because they are intriguing, you might be cutting off your own future.
Finally, a look inside the black box. Researchers are applying causality theory, specifically Judea Pearl's causal hierarchy, to mechanistic interpretability, trying to see how large language models actually reason.
This is covered in a paper asking pretty directly, can we understand how large language models reason? Instead of just observing correlations inside a transformer, they want to use interventions, the do calculus, to locate specific circuits or attention heads, and then see if downstream outputs change predictably.
Hacker News commenter Calf raised a beautiful problem, though. Neural networks gain their power from ever more complex connections. It's like trying to decompile an encrypted tangle. The complexity might grow faster than our ability to extract a clean causal graph from it.
So the next signal to watch is automated causal abstraction, where you try to align high-level components with low-level parameters. But we have to accept that the map we get back may always be a probability, not a perfect deterministic wiring diagram.
Let's open with the Nace Place, a platform that feels pulled straight out of 1998 in the best possible way. It's a free web host where more than 1.6 million sites are reviving that early web ethos of individual creativity. No ads, no algorithms, just an in-browser HTML editor and a corner of the internet you actually control.
And the founder, Kyle Drake, was very deliberate about this. He modeled it directly on the lost spirit of GeoCities, aiming to give anyone a blank canvas. What strikes me is the philosophy. It's not about building a following or optimizing for engagement. The service treats each site as an act of personal expression, proving that self-hosted, independent spaces still hold enormous weight, even as social media consolidates our attention.
It's a quiet rebellion. You get RSS feeds, custom domain support, and a command line tool if you want it. But the core message is that the web can still be a place you build, not just a place you scroll. That's a powerful counter-narrative right now.
Shifting to a more cautionary counter-narrative, there's a paper gaining traction on Hacker News titled Automation Without Understanding. The author, Jun Young Park, points to a strategic error unfolding right now. We have AI systems generating real, research-level mathematics, as you pointed out, but we're also actively weakening the pipeline that trains humans to verify and challenge that reasoning.
That's a chilling disconnect. Park's core claim is that mathematical capacity isn't an accidental byproduct of churning out theorems. It's a distinct, trained ability to scrutinize logic. And if we lose the human skill of deep verification because we just trust the automated output, we become dangerously dependent on systems we can no longer properly challenge or interpret.
The essay frames it as a looming vulnerability. Producing results without comprehension makes critical judgment hollow if the muscles behind it atrophy. It's a warning that the full preprint on Archive really digs into, arguing that social resilience depends on keeping that human interpretability layer sharp, not just getting the right answer faster.
Keeping us grounded in concrete results, let's look at a production win that avoids that comprehension trap by directly measuring impact. Ploy ran their AI agent on Claude Opus for 4 months with no superior alternative, but that changed with the release of GPT 5.6 Seal in July 9, 2026.
And the migration results Lorenzo Gentile published are the kind engineers live for. They cut per-task latency by 2.2 times and drove overall costs down 27%. Think about that. 27% cheaper to run a production agent.
The speed came from a pure inference time win. The model simply required fewer reasoning tokens and generated final outputs faster without the team touching their tool calling or retrieval architecture. The cost savings then layered lower per token pricing on top of that slimmer token consumption. A double dividend.
I also appreciate their deployment discipline. They pinned the agent to a specific snapshot to dodge early release turbulence. Gentile notes their bars was high enough that no model had challenged Opus before, making GPT 5.6 Sol the first frontier release to deliver a clear end-to-end win on both latency and spend simultaneously. That's a real-world signal worth tracking.
From one form of engineering elegance to another, the Tiny Emulators project on Hacker News shows how recreating classic hardware can be an exercise in extreme minimalism. It bundles browser-based simulations of the Commodore 64, ZX Spectrum, and Amstrad CPC, among others, all in strikingly tiny code footprints.
What I love here is the philosophy. The author proves that constraints, no native installs, minuscule file sizes, actually drive clever architectural decisions. For instance, the project integrates discrete chip-level models like Visual 6502 and Visual Z80 Remix. You can literally inspect the processor's internals while running software, all in a browser tab.
It also layers on period-appropriate programming environments in a beautiful way. You can fire up ROM BASIC or 4th on a Z1013 or CP/M2.2 on an Amstrad CPC, often just by typing a string into the UI. This is a community of preservationists who see restricted resources not as a wall, but as the spark for portable, self-contained, historical fidelity. Constraints breed the elegance.
And now we pivot to a constraint that's anything but elegant physical energy capacity. A new report covered by the Register reveals that data centers in Ireland now consume a staggering 23% of the country's total electricity. That's up sharply from around 18% in previous years, driven by the expansion of cloud computing and AI workloads concentrated around Dublin.
This is a defining policy collision. National grid operator EirGrid has warned that demand could hit 30% by 2030, straining a grid that's simultaneously trying to decarbonize. The tension is intense because Ireland already faces challenges meeting its climate targets, and this boom directly complicates cutting overall national emissions.
The response from regulators has been to introduce stricter connection criteria, effectively capping new data center approvals where the grid is short. But that's creating a side effect. Some operators are now pushing for on-site gas generation or private renewable deals to bypass grid constraints, which critics argue just locks in fossil fuel dependency and diverts clean energy away from homes. It's a digital economy meeting a hard physical wall.
Severe from hidden complexities, a privacy concern has surfaced in Chromium 148 that is exceptionally quiet and hard to block. The hyperbolic tangent math function, math.tan, along with some CSS and web audio operations, is now a reliable operating system fingerprinting surface.
The root cause is deceptively mundane. When JavaScript does math in V8, it eventually hands the calculation off to the host system's standard math library, libdag. And the implementations on Linux, macOS, and Windows disagree in the tiniest, least significant bits of the floating point result.
To the naked eye, math.tan of 0.8 looks the same across platforms, but the internal bit patterns differ. Automated scripts can read those bits to silently bucket your session by operating system. Anti-bot vendors are already harvesting this because it's so quiet. No canvas noise, no audio prompts, just one line of math that reliably leaks your OS family even across private browsing windows.
And here's the kicker. Chromium engineers flagged this as a fingerprinting surface, but the browser can't easily fix it alone. A proper fix would require replacing LeadMay calls with a cross-platform software math library or perfectly reproducing Apple's math routines. Massive projects far beyond a simple patch. So for now, a function marketed as a pure calculation has become a persistent de facto OS sniffer.
On a brighter note, let's turn to a possible public health bonus hiding in plain sight. Emerging evidence suggests the shingles vaccine may cut dementia risk by roughly 20%. That's according to large observational studies and a recent analysis highlighted by The Economist.
The protective effect seems strongest with the newer recombinant vaccine, Shingrix, not the older live one. The core mechanism isn't fully nailed down, but a leading theory is that by preventing reactivation of the varicella-zoster virus, the shot reduces neuroinflammation, which is a known driver of cognitive decline. The size of that effect is on par with some lifestyle factors we take very seriously.
However, access lags behind the evidence. Many health systems still restrict coverage based on the upfront cost, which you mentioned is around $300, and often limit it to older age groups. Public health experts are arguing that a broader recommendation could be a no-brainer for brain protection. But policy hasn't caught up yet.
Right, and the scientific caution is warranted. Researchers are now pushing for a randomized controlled trial to confirm causality, not just correlation. But if that confirms the signal, it could reshape vaccination strategy to be a universal tool for healthier aging, which would be a remarkable dual-purpose outcome from a single shot.
For our final topic, let's zoom out and look at an honest voice in the AI conversation. Creator George Hotz, known for his blunt takes, wrote a piece that climbed Hacker News. He draws a sharp line between his genuine giddiness about LLMs and the suffocating hype cycle around them.
And the excitement he describes is practical. He talks about setting up a local coding agent with GLM 5.2, asking it to install software with his configuration, and being genuinely amazed that it just works. For someone who's devoted his career to this since 2014, he calls it a potential year of the Linux desktop moment, a real, tangible step forward.
But what he hates is what he calls negative valence hype. Those scare narratives about a closing window, a perpetual underclass, or you being hopelessly behind. He argues these alarmist stories are mostly designed to pressure people into moving to San Francisco, a city he says really does suck, just like the promoters claim, to manipulate with fear rather than inspire with actual capability.
So he lands on a nuanced point. You can love the raw progress, the magic of an agent that honestly understands your intent, while completely rejecting the marketing-driven panic. It's a call to engage with LLMs on their actual merits, separating the signal of real, working code from the deafening noise of hype.
This is the kind of head-to-head that makes engineering teams sit up and pay attention. SystemOp published a detailed comparison this week, and the headline number is stark. Claude Code sends roughly 33,000 tokens before it even reads your prompt.
And OpenCode, running against the same Anthropic endpoint, sends only about 7,000 tokens in that same pre-prompt window. That is a nearly 5x difference baked into the harness itself. System messages, environment context, tool definitions, not the model's response.
The investigation started because the team had to switch from OpenCode to Claude Code temporarily, and they noticed the usage meter climbing much faster. So they added logging and collected empirical data to confirm what their hunch was telling them.
And the implication for anyone tracking per-session token budgets is significant. That fixed overhead gets re-injected on every turn, so it compounds across a long coding session and degrades cache reuse compared to a leaner harness.
The takeaway is not that one tool is better. It is that agent architecture directly governs recurring cost and latency. Developers who care about API spend should be scrutinizing how their chosen coding assistant structures context, not just how well the model answers.
On a completely different note, here is a small trick from journalism that more people should know about. When you are drafting and you hit a missing word, a forgotten fact, or an uncertain transition, you type two letters, TK, and you keep moving.
This comes from a 2024 essay by Mark, and it is editorial shorthand for to come. The reason it works so well is that the letter pair TK almost never appears together in English, so later you can search your document and instantly find every unfilled gap.
And that is the key. Instead of breaking your momentum to research or polish, you preserve your train of thought. The messy first pass becomes an orderly revision checklist, where a quick search highlights exactly what needs attention before you finalize.
The method applies across writing, coding, and really any creative task where flow matters. It turns out that deferring the interruption is often the difference between finishing a draft and losing an afternoon to one stubborn sentence.
For heavy users of Claude Code, there is a limited time change worth knowing about. Anthropic has launched a promotion running from May 13 through July 19, 2026, that increases weekly usage limits by 50%.
The bump applies to Pro, Max, and Team plans, plus legacy seat-based enterprise users, but it explicitly excludes free plans and consumption-based enterprise seats. No action is needed to activate it. The higher threshold just appears.
One detail to note is that the 5-hour usage caps stay unchanged during the promotion. So you get more capacity across the week, but the per-session ceiling is still there, which matters if you tend to run long, continuous coding stretches.
The promotion gives teams roughly 2 extra months of elevated capacity, which is useful for anyone pushing Claude Code hard right now. The open question, of course, is whether Anthropic later ties permanent ceiling adjustments to upgraded plan tiers once this window closes.
Sometimes a single mailing list reply captures an entire philosophy, and Theo DeRout's 2007 message on the OpenBSD list is one of those. A user suggested that x86 virtualization offered security benefits and Theo did not hold back.
The line everyone remembers. You've been smoking something really mind-altering, and I think you should share it. But the substance behind it was that he saw virtualization as layering another full kernel full of bugs on top of an architecture he considered barely capable of correct page protection.
His argument, in characteristically blunt form, was that the same engineers who cannot secure operating systems or applications would not suddenly write virtualization layers without holes. He called the claim of security benefits absolutely deluded, if not stupid.
The exchange remains a touchstone for a reason. It is not just colorful. It is a concrete technical argument about complexity and trust, delivered with a candor that open source communities often celebrate but rarely archive so memorably.
Let us step into deeper mathematical waters for a moment. A piece on Hacker News asks a simple question: why study Diophantine equations? And the answer reveals why these ancient problems still drive modern discovery.
A Diophantine equation is just a polynomial where you are looking for integer solutions, which sounds niche until you realize that this pursuit repeatedly exposes deep, unexpected structures in the integers.
As the article notes, the aim of mathematics is to uncover hidden structures, much like an author reveals a general emotional idea through a specific story. A certain class of these equations led directly to the Langlands program, one of the most profound frameworks in modern number theory.
So the takeaway is that even these ancient questions about whole numbers are not dusty relics. They are engines of discovery, and the fact that they continue to generate new mathematics says something about how much structure is still waiting to be found.
Now for a show HN that caught our eye. Shirai is a new cross-platform GUI framework, and its distinguishing feature is that it is built entirely in native Go. No CGO dependencies at all.
The project lives at github.com/aacg/go-sharia, and it targets desktop applications across platforms. The pitch is straightforward. If you are a Go developer, you get to ship a GUI without binding to GTK, Qt, or wrestling with a C toolchain.
That eliminates a whole category of cross-compilation headaches, which is a real pain point for Go teams that want to ship desktop tools. The question is whether it can compete with established toolkits on widget completeness, rendering performance, and platform fidelity.
Those details, windowing backends, accessibility support, native look and feel on Windows, macOS, and Linux, are not yet demonstrated in the initial public push. The early signals worth watching are the issue tracker and community contribution velocity.
But the underlying idea addresses a long-standing desire in the Go ecosystem for a lighter way to build GUIs, and a pure Go approach is genuinely appealing if the execution holds up.
We need to talk about a serious security finding. A researcher going by Mr. Brew has published an unauthenticated remote code execution vulnerability in Motorola's MR2600 router, running firmware version 1.0.22.
Unauthenticated means an attacker does not need a password. They can push a malicious firmware image onto the device from the internet and take full control. This is about as severe as a router vulnerability gets.
Motorola rarely distributes firmware publicly, but they made an exception for the MR2600, a Wi-Fi 5 model whose final update shipped in mid-2024. The researcher systematically hunted for an RCE per router vendor and found that the firmware upload step has no authentication check at all.
And here is the part that makes this a lasting problem. No fix is planned, because the MR2600 is end of life. Publicly accessible IPv4 scans already show thousands of these routers. Owners should remove them from any network facing the public internet immediately.
The broader lesson is that when vendors control firmware distribution through over-the-air channels and then stop shipping patches, customers are stranded with permanently vulnerable hardware. It also shows that low-end consumer routers still often lack even basic authentication on sensitive management functions.
We will close this segment with a story that is about extinction, but not of species, of craft. When Jurassic Park was in production, Steven Spielberg hired Phil Tippett, the legendary stop-motion animator, to bring the full-body dinosaurs to life with his go-motion technique.
Then Industrial Light and Magic rendered a fully textured, photorealistic T-Rex chasing Gallimus in full sunlight. Spielberg saw it and said, in effect, "That is what we are doing now." The stop-motion models were suddenly artifacts, and Tippett's reaction became famous. "I think I'm extinct."
Spielberg later put a version of that line in the film, but the weight behind it was genuine. An entire discipline, a rare tactile language of movement built over decades, was collapsing under the rise of CGI in a matter of months.
And the reflection, captured in a piece by Fabian Sanglard, is that when a skill set that complex vanishes, you lose more than technique. You lose an intimate understanding of how creatures move through a frame, a kind of knowledge that cannot simply be resurrected from the fossil record.
It is a reminder that extinction, whether biological or cultural, is not just an absence. It is the end of a way of knowing. And sometimes we only realize what we have lost when someone says it out loud.
Even watching the litter room and panniers, it's a security pattern of you in that repairing this chepper GDAP, bethinking that the next paddock, believing God's knees, is painting them steply. I absolutely think, for a grieving, to get him to seize the hour loan sufficiently, perfectly dabling my convenes their specluity as I crease my boat. Thanks. A University of Chicago study published in the Journal of Labor Economics has a finding that feels almost contradictory at first glance. They analyzed over 80 million scientific publications and found that when research teams adopt AI tools, individual productivity goes way up. More papers, faster career advancement, more citations.
So on the surface, that sounds like an unqualified win. But the study points to a paradox, right? When you zoom out to the field level, the same AI tools correlate with a measurable narrowing in the variety of problem formulations, conceptual approaches, and theoretical frameworks.
Exactly. The individual incentives push toward maximizing output, and AI is incredibly effective at helping with that. Writing, data analysis, hypothesis generation. But that efficiency seems to come at a cost, crowding out the unconventional or harder-to-quantify work that often drives real breakthroughs.
It raises this uncomfortable question for funding agencies and universities. If we keep optimizing evaluation metrics around sheer volume, are we accidentally building a system that rewards intellectual homogeneity?
Let's shift to a different corner of the tech world. There's a book gathering attention on Hacker News called Understanding the Odin Programming Language by Carl Zelinsky. It introduces Odin as a systems language focused on clarity, performance, and, the author uses this word deliberately, joy.
And I think the positioning is interesting because it's explicitly not trying to be a C or Rust or Zig competitor. Zelinsky teaches manual memory management, parametric polymorphism, data-oriented design, but the philosophy leans into something different, understanding your tools deeply. Not just how to write Odin code, but why the language works the way it does, to become a better craftsperson.
So, in a landscape where Zig emphasizes safety and C interop, and Rust has the borrow checker, Odin seems to say, let's make straightforward procedures powerful again, and let that clarity be the main design goal.
On a related note of personal practice, Elia Scotto wrote a piece that resonated widely, 274 points on HN, about how he went from fewer than 10 books a year to roughly one a week. His core argument isn't about scheduling more reading time.
He says the trick is a simple gear switch. In every moment of inactivity where most people instinctively pull out their phone, serious readers pull out a book instead. Replace one default behavior with another until it becomes automatic.
and he points to Umberto Eco's library of over 30,000 volumes as a visual inspiration, suggesting that volume and depth can coexist. The foundation is consistency, not speed or forced discipline. Scotto promises that once the habit sticks, both enjoyment and comprehension compound over time.
There's something quietly radical in that. It reframes reading not as an aspiration you carve out special time for, but as the thing you do in the gaps everyone else fills with scrolling.
Staying with the theme of making things understandable, there's a neat visualization project on HN. Someone built interactive sequence diagrams for YTDLP, the popular open-source video downloader, and hosted them on Islegraph.
The demo walks through the internal request flow for downloading a YouTube video, which makes the architecture much easier to reason about. It sits alongside other sample diagrams covering things like serverless AWS backends and Stack Overflow's on-premises data center.
It's a reminder that complex software internals don't have to be opaque. A well-designed sequence diagram can turn a tangled code base into something you can explore interactively. The post hit 55 points, which shows there's a real appetite for using visualization to demystify the tools we rely on.
From visualizing tools to living inside them completely. There's a new Emacs package called Ghostl.l that embeds a full terminal emulator powered by the libghostl library. It installs from Melpe, or source, and requires building a native module.
And this is not a minimal toy. It has distinct input modes: char mode, Emacs mode, copy mode, semi-char mode, line mode, each with dedicated key bindings. It handles shell integration, link and file detection, clipboard, and even the Kitty graphics protocol for inline images, though that has known limitations.
Password prompt detection, scrollback search outside copy mode, bookmarking. The package is thorough. The post reached 256 points, which tells you the long-running Emacs as operating system idea is still alive and well. A high-performance terminal now lives right alongside the editor's other tools.
It pushes that boundary further. If your editor can also be your terminal, the distinction between writing code and running it starts to dissolve in a really interesting way.
Let's talk about reviewing what AI coding agents actually do. Because a ShowHN project called MindWalk reached 136 points with a novel approach. It replays coding agent sessions on an interactive 3D map of your codebase.
Imagine your codebase rendered as a navigable terrain where each file is a raised block, sized and colored by change frequency. During a replay, you see an agent avatar move across the map in real time, visiting files, reading contents, making edits. There's a timeline scrubber to pause, rewind, or fast forward.
The goal is to shift code review away from flat diffs and logs toward a spatial understanding of the agent's behavior. You can spot inefficient patterns, thrashing between files or repeated unnecessary reads just by watching the movement path and dwell time.
That spatial feedback loop could directly inform better prompt design and agent guardrails. The project hints at future extensions too. Playback markers beyond file-level changes, cost or token overlays, and potentially using the 3D replay as a shared review artifact for teams. It reframes the question from "what changed?" to "what did the agent actually do and where did it focus?"
Terence Tao, the mathematician, recently shared a fascinating use case for modern coding agents. Back in 1999, he wrote interactive math applets in Java 1.0 for his complex analysis and linear algebra courses. They fell out of use when browsers dropped support for that version of Java, and the manual maintenance burden was too high.
Now he's using AI-powered coding agents to rapidly refactor those old code bases into modern web-friendly formats. He restores the educational functionality and even extends them toward new mathematical explorations. The post got 389 points on HN.
What Dao emphasizes isn't just resuscitating dead code. The agent acts as a bridge, bringing legacy academic software into alignment with current development practices. Brittle historical assets become living, updatable resources for both teaching and research.
It's a compelling example of agents solving a very real, very specific kind of technical debt that otherwise would have stayed buried forever.
We'll close this segment with a philosophical question that Doug Turnbull put directly in a recent essay. Why write code in 2026? His argument starts from the premise that the software engineer's role is now to build and maintain the software factory.
That factory is the infrastructure of agents, prompts, knowledge bases, agents.md files, automated evaluations, linting, and type systems. The assembly line keeps even a mediocre model on track with fresh context, making it seem almost ridiculous to look at code and laughable to write it by hand.
But Turnbull insists something essential remains human. It's not typing syntax. It's forming intent, judging trade-offs, and stewarding the long-term coherence of a system. The distinctly human part is the judgment and the responsibility.
The essay is really a bet on a next signal, watching whether engineers who continue reading and reasoning about source code sustain an advantage in system design, debugging, and evolution when the factory layer drifts. The question isn't whether to use agents, it's whether you still understand what they're building on your behalf.
Milo, every so often, a show HN launches that makes you do a double take. And this one is called LARP. Short for Revenue Infrastructure for Serious Founders.
I saw that. The tagline is, revenue is just an agreement between friends, and the mechanics are almost too simple. It pairs you with another founder. You send them $10,000, they send $10,000 right back, and both of you book the full amount as revenue instantly.
Exactly. Cash never leaves, the books balance, and suddenly you have a recurring revenue line that looks very healthy for investors. Global LARC volume this year is reportedly $4.24 billion, and the quiet part is that zero of it is real.
The published numbers are almost parodic in their seriousness. Median recognition latency under 400 milliseconds, 99.98% settlement uptime, annual SOC 2 Type 2 audits. They list over 400 finance and accounting teams as users, and named firms like Verithor, Northbank, Cadenza Systems, and Meridian.
The satire lands because it is so precisely dressed as infrastructure. The design target is early-stage founders who need Series A-ready metrics, and the platform is built as if that revenue engineering were a legitimate product category.
And that is the uncomfortable mirror it holds up. If reciprocal booking without customers, product, or real cash movement can be plumbed like a microservice, then the gap between that and some of the revenue recognition we see in real portfolios is thinner than anyone wants to admit.
So the joke isn't really LARP. The joke is how easily it could pass for a startup that gets a term sheet. The whole thing works as a launch announcement because it makes you stop and ask what revenue is actually measuring.
And on that reflective note, that is our show for today. I'm Milo.
I'm Mia. The stories today ran from deep reading and writing tricks all the way to utilities, emulators, and a perfectly deadpan satire of startup metrics.
As always, check the show notes for links to every piece we discussed. And thank you for spending part of your day with us.
We'll be back with the next edition soon. Until then, keep the curiosity up and the hype filter on.